This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, what long-term impact will the Ferguson protests have on American society? Also, ISIS executes American journalist James Foley. Should the U.S. have paid ransom for him? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Dana Stevens. On this week's Culture Gabfest, movie soundtracks. What is the perfect marriage of song and film? And then, is ironically hating men the next wave in feminism? And then, The Giver, a beloved 20-year-old young adult novel, is now the latest Hollywood dystopia pick.
Hello? My name...
I know who you are.
Who are you?
The Giver. When the elders need guidance, I provide wisdom using memories of the past.
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The protests in Ferguson, Missouri have quieted down almost 2 weeks after a police officer shot and killed Michael Brown. Attorney General Eric Holder is visiting the St. Louis suburb. No charges have been filed in Brown's death, and the president has hardly said a word. Will Ferguson have any long-term impact on American life? Then, American journalist James Foley was executed this week by ISIS. His captors then circulated a gruesome video of the decapitation. Should the U.S. be negotiating with terrorist kidnappers? Joining me today is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon in New York. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David.
And sitting in for John Dickerson is Mike Pesca, host of the Slate podcast, The Gist with Mike Pesca, also in New York. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Ferguson, Missouri remains at the center of national attention this week. The nightly protests that have dominated the news have simmered down quite a bit. Eric Holder, the attorney general, has traveled to St. Louis to talk about the crisis there. There has been much discussion, but no real news about whether prosecutors are going to charge Darren Wilson, the police officer who allegedly shot and killed Michael Brown. I left for my largely off-the-grid vacation on August 9th when Brown was shot and returned on August 20th as things simmered down. So I have missed most of this national convulsion, so I'm going to need you guys to explain it for me. So, Emily, just on the legal question, what are the issues or what are the steps that we need to think about before Wilson is or is not charged? What needs to happen?
The prosecutor has decided that he's going to take this case to a grand jury and try to get them to bring an indictment. And the issue is whether Officer Wilson used excessive force and whether this was an unjustified homicide or a justified one. And that will turn on the very minute-by-minute specifics of what happened when the police stopped Michael Brown and his friend Dorian Johnson. And what witnesses reported, what the forensic evidence shows, how the cops' stories about the incident hold up. It's all very much going to turn on the precise circumstance of these multiple shootings and what Wilson and Brown were each doing as these awful, lethal minutes unfolded.
And as a betting woman, do you have any sense about how strong this case might or may not be? Or do we just not know enough yet?
I think it's hard to tell. I mean, if you go by some of the witness accounts, it seems like this was an unjustified homicide. In particular, Dorian Johnson makes it sound like Brown was standing there with his hands up when the last shot was fired. I'm not sure we know whether that last shot was the one that killed him. We know that he could have survived all but the shot to his head. But that account, which was the account that initially, you know, zoomed through the media and the internet, makes Wilson sound at fault. However, there are other witnesses who say they witnessed some kind of tussle at the side of this patrol car. The cop says that Brown hit him in the face. He was treated at the hospital. And then there are witnesses who say that when the last shot was fired, when Brown was outside the car, that maybe he was moving toward Wilson and maybe his hands weren't up in the air. And so Wilson has to, in order to have justified lethal force, Wilson has to have been fearing for his own life or trying to prevent the deaths or, you know, bodily harm of others. And so this question of what Brown was doing, how far away he was, how menacing or not his posture toward Wilson was at that moment, that seems like the crucial question.
And complicating this is who the prosecuting attorney is.
Yes.
This guy, McCulloch, Robert McCulloch, whose father was a St. Louis cop who was killed in the line of duty by actually an African-American assailant. And his mother worked with the police for years and years. But he's been the prosecuting attorney there for a long time, has been elected by the people, I think, since the 90s. He also criticized Jay Nixon. So he's already stepped into this.
The governor.
Criticized the governor for essentially trying to tamp down some tensions. It seems like the kind of case to me, you tell me, Emily, but it seems like the kind of case to me that if there wasn't a tension based on it, I could see that it would be viewed as a, you know, what they call a good shooting, a justified shooting, because so few shootings are viewed as unjustified, actually, especially in those jurisdictions.
A good shooting, viewed as a good shooting by the cops, you mean, and by the law enforcement?
Yeah, I would think, I don't know if an indictment would be returned, but it is so very rare to have a murder or a similar charge against a policeman who says, you know, I feared for myself. There was a tussle. He came at me. I mean, those set of facts alone, I sensed he was reaching for a gun. Those set of facts alone are usually enough to get a cop off on a murder charge.
Yeah, but maybe that isn't what should be the case. I mean, we do defer to police in these circumstances and essentially give them the benefit of the doubt. But the circumstances of this case really are putting a spotlight on whether we should be. And I know these cases are different incidents, but it is not helpful to your argument, not that you're making it necessarily, but to the good shooting idea, that the man who was killed in North St. Louis this week, his shooting, the police gave an account of that made it sound like a justified homicide. When you watch the video shot by a guy who was standing there on the street, I don't know about you, I didn't think it was justified at all. I was horrified. It seemed like someone, the man who was shot, someone who is either mentally ill or on drugs, in like a split second, it takes the cops 15 seconds to open fire in this barrage of bullets from when they show up on the scene. And what this guy did was, you know, shoplift a couple of cans of soda and some other stuff from a store and then put the sodas down on the street in front of him. He's like kind of pacing in this weird way, but he's not menacing any passersby. It's really upsetting. And, you know, the Brown shooting has its whole own set of circumstances, but I really question why McCulloch is so insistent that he's trying to. I mean, it's almost like a movie what's happening with him, right? He's like the super popular prosecutor. Why should he step aside? It's a huge case. Well, except he has the family history you just outlined. He's refused to prosecute cops in other shootings of unarmed Black people. And the whole Black community, essentially, in this part of the country is saying, please, we don't trust this guy. The only people sticking up for him, as far as I can hear so far, are white people like Senator Claire McCaskill. And so you just feel like if this shooting was justified and there is no indictment and it's McCulloch at the center of it, it's not going to matter what the facts are because people are not going to trust it.
Well, but doesn't it disturb you that there's the same urging towards prosecution? What if he is indicted? What if there is a charge brought? Can we trust that? There's been this public fury that has been an enormous pressure to indict this cop.
Yeah. I mean, so these kinds of moments make me incredibly nervous because it's as if the whole weight of racial history and injustice in America is coming down to whether this officer goes to prison or not and is tried and found guilty, like all of that. And maybe the facts of this case don't actually bear that weight. But whatever the answer to that question is, I wish that the process was one that everyone was going to be able to feel had all of the things that would make them feel like it's fair. In other words, a prosecutor who seems neutral, who doesn't have this kind of history. And it's not that I hold that history against McCulloch exactly. It's more just that I feel like it's hugely unfortunate that his ego is so big that he can't realize that what matters most here is for the country, and particularly the Blacks of St. Louis and the region, to have as much help trusting the process as is manageable. And his presence is not helpful for that.
Why do you guys think that the protests are simmering down? We've had almost 2 weeks of nightly protests. They're still going on, but they are much muted. Is it just that people are worn out? There's nothing left to accomplish? The police tactics have gotten better? What is it?
Well, it seemed right away that the police tactics were wrong for 2 or 3 days, and the visuals of police in riot gear and heavily militarized police and the stuff that libertarians like Rand Paul criticized. And by the way, I'd be interested to hear if you thought that on the actual basis of his criticism. Why have we militarized the police, if that's actually a good criticism, even though it totally fits in with what we're seeing here. But so it seems like things were so mishandled. And when you, you know, hear the news conferences of the people who were in charge at first, and when you consider their decisions to, you know, release that videotape of Michael Brown shoving the store clerk after he allegedly, although it seems pretty clearly on that video, stole a few cigars. When you consider that that's the mindset of the people who are making decisions, it just seems like there was nowhere to go but up. Then for a day or two, they put the highway patrol in charge. Things seem to be a little better. But it's not that easy. And, you know, I could trot out all the MLK quotes about how a riot is, you know, the communication of the voiceless. And it's also true, the other cliches about a few bad apples or people trying to take advantage of a situation is also true. So, I mean, I do think that you had terrible police decisions in the beginning, inciting a spark, and then the spark smolders, you know, and can catch fire again and again, and eventually it has to die out. I think that the protesters, they're saying so many things, and in some ways, by like looting stores, they're not saying anything productive. But I think by and large, maybe the protesters are feeling that their voice at this point has been heard.
Well, and also there is this black peacekeeping informal force in Ferguson now that is standing between the protesters and the cops, and they've diffused some moments that could have escalated.
All right, last question on this. There have been a spate. By spate, I mean I saw one guy on TV and then I read one op-ed, but I bet there are more. There's been a spate of cops telling people you really need to behave yourself around cops. Like, the best advice that I, as a cop, can give you today is when you're confronted by a police officer, be quiet, obedient, non-confrontational. Is it useful for cops to be telling people this?
Well, look, I mean, there are two ways to think about this. One is pre-escalation and one is after you think something unjust and wrong and misconduct has happened to you. You know, pre-escalation, yes, be polite to the police in the way that you do with every government official or every assume people are trying to do their job. I mean, and I also think there's, as I've talked before, there's reason to fear the police. So, I mean, I absolutely tell my kids to be incredibly deferential and try to model that for them. I mean, it's the only time I ever use the word sir and ma'am is when I'm talking to the police. All of that said, the notion that if something unfair happens to you, you can't speak up and you're just supposed to, like, put your hands out to be cuffed, get led away, and then later on try to do something about that. I mean, I just find that incredibly upsetting that that's where we are. We're just supposed to take it and hope someone's taking, like, a Gonzo Citizen video to bear out our account later, because in the moment, the things that happen with the police, that's if you lose your chance to react in a way that is defending yourself or challenging them in the moment, then you usually lose the chance to do anything about it at all. And this is why a lot of why I just feel like if you can keep the police out of your ordinary interactions with people, you should.
Coming up, should the U.S. pay ransom to kidnappers to save American lives? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and Mike Pesca, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. A program note, this is the final episode of GabFest Radio, but you'll still be able to hear podcast versions of the political and culture GabFest each and every week. Just visit iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and search for Slate GabFest. And if you'd like to leave a comment or a farewell, you can do either on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, on to our next topic. American journalist James Foley was executed this week by the ISIS kidnappers who had been holding him for more than 2 years. Foley was decapitated by his captors in a gruesome video that ISIS circulated. It's something I couldn't bring myself to watch and look at, although we'll talk about whether Mike and Emily did. His executioner, who seems to be British-born based on his accent, or at least British-raised, said Foley was being killed in retaliation for U.S. airstrikes. ISIS also threatened to murder another U.S. journalist it's holding hostage. So did you guys watch this video or look at these photos?
There's no way I was going to.
Yeah.
I'm not squeamish. I just, why? Who does it help to do that?
Right. Emily, you too?
Yeah, I mean, I am squeamish, but I agree with Mike, and I also feel like I don't want to. I don't know if it's helping the people who did this to watch it, but it seems like it's buying into the way they've framed the issue. I mean, look, you know, it also, I suppose, is important to witness the horror that they're perpetrating, but they put it out there for us to watch. I don't want to give them that.
Yeah.
So the most interesting part of this horror I think, comes to the big public policy question raised about whether to pay ransom. So Foley, there was a ransom demanded quietly, secretly by ISIS. The United States government and its associated entities refused to pay it, refused to negotiate with him, with the captors. Whereas, as the New York Times reported brilliantly, hostages from European countries that have been held have been freed thanks to ransoms in the tens, even $100 million total paid by European nations. It's not clear to me whether it's paid by governments or private, but paid by European entities to al-Qaeda, basically, that funding al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda affiliates like ISIS, which is sort of a, it's not exactly an al-Qaeda affiliate, but let's just say it is for the sake of this, are making money by taking hostages and holding them for ransom, but the U.S. will not pay ransom. So should the U.S. have paid? Should the U.S. be paying to free its citizens who are held by these murderers?
No. I mean, it feels incredibly harsh in the moment because someone was just killed in a terrible way because of this policy. But I find it honestly morally abhorrent what the Europeans and these other countries are doing, because they are feeding the kidnapping and also because they are funding these groups that are doing other terrible things. I mean, their payments are the main source of revenue. And it just seems like this incredibly dirty set of transactions, and it saves a few lives, but at what cost?
Well, what about private businesses? Should they be paying? Can't stop them from paying.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a different question. I guess you could say that they have a different obligation to their employees than governments have to citizens. And so if they want to pay as a private matter, that's on them. The problems still stand, though. You're increasing the incentive to kidnap, and you're funding groups that go on to use your money for awful things that you just don't have to actually watch.
But if private businesses pay, then the stance of governments won't matter. I mean, if kidnappers know that the people they kidnap represent a cash cow from someone, they're not going to be dissuaded because, you know, 30, 20, 35% of the potentially kidnapped won't have people behind them who will pay.
Right. Mike, do you guys remember from the Time story, I don't remember, are the European ransoms being paid by government or by?
Yeah, a lot of the money comes from governments. They get laundered through. You know, it's like a pretend humanitarian payment that goes to some middleman. But yes, they're
coming. But the source is not a corporation.
Government.
The source is government.
I mean, I think both are happening, but I think there are certainly governments that are paying, yes.
And private companies like media companies have insurance, and sometimes their insurance pays. I've talked to David Rode about this, who was when he worked for the New York Times, he was kidnapped. He was in Afghanistan. And, you know, he doesn't even come out by saying we should or we shouldn't. But the most important thing is that consistency. And also, let's do away with the fiction that we don't negotiate with terrorists. That does nobody any good. Of course we do. And of course we should. And we should try not only to negotiate, but do what we did, which is, you know, try to extract this guy. I mean, it's a tough conundrum. I also would say that ISIS would definitely have engaged in kidnapping, even if they didn't want any cash reward. And in fact, they didn't accept any cash reward, because it entirely fits in with what they want to do. And what ISIS wants to do is to terrorize the United States, to send a message. You know, this is one of ISIS's worst weeks in the last months, because they were bombed away from the dam and they've been losing ground in Syria. So that's why they did the action and released the video now to try to reestablish
themselves.
They're
unusual in this way, right? I mean, this is part of why they got kicked out of al-Qaeda, was that they have these brutal killings.
But they're unusually successful.
Yeah,
well, but
I think
that's a short-term success, Mike. I don't think in 5 years we're going to be talking about ISIS as being this tremendous entity. I mean, for one thing, it's very hard when you're a terrorist organization. It's very hard to hold territory because people don't like you. They don't want to deal with you, and they want a military get rid of. It's hard to terrorize a population consistently over a significant period of time. So what should the U.S. be doing about ISIS? Let's wrap with that.
Well, I think bombing them when they're out in the field turned out to have been a good strategy. I think that ultimately they have to let Iraq settle it for themselves. So, and this is why it's good that Maliki is out. You know, this is the Iraqis, or at least that faction of Iraqis that's been ruling the country's problem. And if they don't solve their own problem by beating back the fighters, then, you know, I'm not going to say they don't deserve to have a country, but there's no basis to say, yes, that's what Iraq should be, a country that can't defend itself, a country that, you know, can't turn away these, you know, totally radical Sunnis who don't have any real appeal besides anger. So, yeah, I think that it is another one of these world headaches. And so far, we're doing as best we can.
Should we be pushing the Europeans to stop paying these ransoms?
Well, again, I don't think that if... I don't think if that policy was in place, it would dissuade them from doing the kidnappings. It's been tactically a great triumph for them.
Well, this in terms of ISIS, yes, because ISIS actually kills hostages for the sake of killing hostages and defying the U.S. But in terms of the worldwide situation of kidnappings, yes, it would help if people stopped paying ransoms. And some people would die along the way, which would be terrible.
That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture GabFest starts right now.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm Dana Stevens. On this week's Slate Culture GabFest, Lois Lowry's award-winning novel The Giver is now a movie. The book spawned dystopic children's literature like The Hunger Games and Divergent, but is it 20 years too late for Hollywood? And then, ironic misandry. Is it feminism's sharp new teeth, or is it just plain mean? And finally, movie soundtracks. We discuss the best marriages of song and screen. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Dana.
And I'm also joined from D.C. by Slate's culture editor and co-host of the Mom and Dad Are Fighting podcast, Dan Coyce. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
All right, on to our first topic, The Giver. This is an adaptation 20 years in coming of Lois Lowry's Newbery Award-winning 1993 novel. It's set, and we'll see if this sounds familiar to any of you, in a dystopian futuristic community where choice has been eliminated so people never have to feel pain, hurt, or love again. Over the past 20 years, The Giver has become one of the most influential young adult novels, the progenitor of novels like The Hunger Games, Divergent, etc. But more than 20 years later, the movie adaptation has finally made it onto screens with Jeff Bridges as its producer and one of its stars as well. What do we think? Was it 20 years too late? I'm going to throw it to you first, Dan, because I know that you're a fan of the novel, and I read the novel sort of in preparation for the movie, but you've been a fan of it for some years. So I want you to share your feelings, The Giver style, and precision of language, please.
I will try to exhibit precision of language. Thank you for throwing to me. I apologize in advance for anything that I may get wrong.
We accept your apology.
Thank you. I was very disappointed by the movie of The Giver, as I think many fans of the novel were. I'm not exactly in the target age group for that book. It has become a real touchstone book for millennials, I think, because it became a curriculum book in many schools in the late 90s and early 2000s. It's also been challenged in many schools for various reasons. We can get into that later. But it's become it's a book that people read in school, and it's one of the first books, I think, for many kids that gives them the notion or authorizes the notion in a way that the people in power in their lives may be lying to them, may be withholding things from them or deceiving them. And I think that's a really powerful notion to come to kids. And for many kids, it comes thanks to The Giver, thanks to Jonas's discovery that the people in power in his community, though they mean the best, are in fact doing monstrous things. And the movie, as is the case with many Hollywood adaptations, has smoothed out some of the things that made The Giver so powerful, and instead has made it sort of, instead of a cry against sameness, it has turned into a sort of tribute to sameness in its attempts to look, sound, and feel like almost every other Hollywood dystopian love triangle adventure that has come out in the last 5 years.
I totally disagree with that. Actually, I thought that the movie was distinctive and looked kind of different and had some different rhythms than some of those other movies. It didn't work or resonate for me, but it was not because it was the same as those other films.
But those different rhythms are solely like the final remaining remnants of the book's actual plot, whereas everything that was changed from the book to the movie was in a sort of dire attempt to make it as much like those other movies as possible.
Ah, well, I have never read the book. It came out just a little bit too late for me to absorb it into my own childhood, and I haven't gone back to it since then. So coming to the story totally cold, I was struck by the fact that this didn't look like a totally shameless Hunger Games ripoff. Obviously, the fact that this movie got made at this era, I think probably owes something to the wild success of some of these teen dystopian franchises like The Hunger Games and Divergent. But, you know, I just saw a trailer a couple weeks ago for The Maze Runner, which is some other thingamajig where the kids, they got to do battle and there's horrible beasties and there's trapped and the blah blah blah, and it just looked like full-on Hunger Games ripoff. And this has a very distinct visual style, very distinct themes that I think are fairly different from the movies that have cropped up recently, And even just its pacing and tone and the form of it, I mean, it was visually a much more interesting movie than some of these other ones that are just full of, like, grungy slash excess of the Hunger Games visual spectrum. So I thought that the movie was not a puddle of sameness. I thought it was bad, but bad in a unique way.
I mean, I think we should all specify this movie is really bad, right? I mean, I really felt like this was one of the this is definitely going to be on the list of the dogs of 2014, I think. There's not a moment of it that has any authenticity. It feels so synthetic and so kind of lazily put together for me. I didn't feel like anyone, including Jeff Bridges, who's gotten some praise for his performance. I mean, I love Jeff Bridges in anything, but he just could not do anything with this role of the grizzled giver of knowledge who sits around in a room full of books and transmits images of Nelson Mandela into a young boy's wrists.
Wait, you didn't think the visuals were kind of cool?
I mean, I guess the use of black and white, it's familiar from Wizard of Oz all the way back. Like, the idea of a colorless world that slowly becomes invaded by color or that gets these patches of color now and then. I guess it expresses that theme of the book fairly well. But there was no moment where I felt dazzled by the visuals. And those dream sequences were just embarrassing. I mean, it was like some mixed montage of kind of nature clips from PBS and, you know, literally Nelson Mandela and the Tiananmen Square tank guy. And none of it contextualized or kind of explained to this boy, but just sort of flashed at him like this YouTube montage that he was supposed to maintain, somehow receive all human knowledge from.
Yeah, YouTube, I think, is an accurate description of the aesthetics of those moments.
It's like a supercut of human civilization.
Right. It was like you told some 22-year-old, hey, can you make me a supercut of human civilization? You've got an hour.
Right.
Well, so here's my question about this movie and my concern with it, which is that the book, what I really prize about the book and what I love about the book is this sense that I've always gotten from Lois Lowry's writing, and something that I wrote about when I profiled her a couple of years ago, which is this sense that she is very specifically talking to kids in a way that many other children's authors don't do. You know, a book like The Hunger Games, I think, is a YA novel in theory, but in practice it's meant to appeal to as broad an audience as possible. Whereas The Giver, specifically, I think, is a book and a story that feels very different to a 12-year-old or an 11-year-old than it does to any adult who would ever read it. I think when adults read this book or see the story, it can seem a little obvious or blunt. It is not hard for us to sort of see the directions the story is going to go. It is not hard for us to tease out the mysteries of what is going on in this universe. For a 12-year-old reading this book, it really does feel like a revelation, I think. And the unveil of that story really, really has a great deal of power, the way that you become aware, as Jonas does, of what is happening in this world. My frustration with the movie is that everything that was done to this story to make this a movie was done for the explicit purpose of broadening its appeal, of making it appeal to older kids by making the main characters older than they are in the book, by adding a romantic subplot, by adding an adventure subplot, by adding a
drone pilot.
A drone pilot who just happens to be one of Jonas's best friends, by adding a scene where Jonas gets picked up by the drone and flown across the landscape and dropped into a river. And so I understand, you know, that when you make a movie out of something, you want as many people as possible to see it. And that is part of the Hollywoodification of any property. But this seemed to me to be a very specific object lesson in the way that a story with very specific, wonderful appeal can get broadened by Hollywood in a way that no longer makes it have any utility even to the people who might once have loved that story. And so it's a real frustration to me because, and I hope it is real frustration to Jeff Bridges too, who has been spending 20 years trying to make this a new movie. I like Jeff Bridges and I think he has good taste and is an interesting guy, but I hope that when he looks at this movie, he feels like this sense of disappointment, because I think that he blew it. I mean, and maybe there was no other option. Maybe there's no other way this movie was ever going to get made. And he's just happy to have it out there. And he hopes that it will send people to the book and it will mean something to them. But this seems to me to be one of the more horrendously botched adaptations of a property that I've seen in a really, really long time. And that frustrates me. It makes me angry.
Maybe he'll get a little injection every morning that will help him forget that it was a bad movie.
Maybe that'll happen. Yes.
All right, so we are sending people to Lois Lowry's Giver. We are sending them away at top speed from the recent adaptation of The Giver. Correct?
Correct.
Coming up,
Is ironic man-hating the next best thing for feminism? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Dana Stevens, along with Julia Turner and Dan Coyce, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. One program note, this is the final episode of Gabfest Radio, but you'll still be able to hear the podcast versions of the Political and Culture Gabfests each and every week. Just visit iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and search for Slate Gabfest. And if you'd like to leave us a comment or just say goodbye, you can do either on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, on to our next topic. On its most basic level, ironic misandry functions like a stuck-out tongue pointed at a playground bully. But ironic misandry is more than just a sarcastic retort to the haters. It's an in-joke that like-minded feminists tell even when their critics aren't looking, as a way to build solidarity within the group. Or so writes Slate's Amanda Hess in her article, The Rise of the Ironic Man-Hater. She's tracking the rise of a recent trend on feminist blogs and in internet conversations about gender that's been named ironic misandry. And I want you guys to help me define this because it is such a vague sort of floating concept. But essentially, we all know what misogyny is, right? It's the hatred of women. The word misandry is something that was not really in the air until, what, the last year or two, maybe?
I mean, it's existed. It's just, you know, a lot less common, I think, maybe, is fair to say. Maybe not. We can debate that. But, you know, it's similarly the hatred of men. And I actually think the easiest way to understand the trend that Amanda's talking about in her very smart piece is some examples. So there are T-shirts that say, I drink male tears. There are mugs you can buy that just say male tears on them. So the notion is that your morning coffee is, in fact, just whatever the men in your life produced after you berated them with your hateful speech. She cites some wonderful examples of this from The Toast, which is a site that Dana, you and I are both big fans of, where one of its creators, Mallory Ortberg, rewrote some nursery rhymes to make them more misandrist. So, hush, little baby, don't say a word. Ever your sister is talking is one of the examples that Amanda cites. So I think you get that, you know, once Amanda pointed to those examples, I was thinking, oh, right, I've seen this around. This is sort of a kind of counterattack type move in wherever we stand in the feminism wars. And I recognize that particular bit of jujitsu.
So I guess we're here to talk about the rise of this trend, what we think of it. Do we think it's funny? Do we think it has anywhere to go or any future or anything to say about feminism? And I noticed that we haven't yet consulted with the man in the room. Dan.
Is he even allowed to talk during the segment?
I'm going to take the lock off of his mouth mask.
Oh, my God, you guys.
Well, we were thinking if we could stretch that intro out even a little bit longer.
So I'm a fan of ironic misandry, and I think one fun thing about ironic misandry for guys is that getting the joke is a really, really great way for guys to literally be like, "Guy, hey, women, I get the joke. It's okay. I'm not threatened."
Oh, but that
it's
somehow
super handy.
Just makes me so sad. I don't know why. I don't know, Dana.
Do you share, Julia, my sense of, I mean, as much as I love The Toast, which I endorsed, I think, on the show, like the week it started, The Toast is hilarious. Mallory Ortberg's takeoff on the misandrist fairy tale is awesome. I think a lot of these jokes are really funny, and I wouldn't say no to a gift of one of the mugs. But as a kind of rhetorical structure, I don't know, I think that this relates to something in culture, particularly internet culture, that I'm not necessarily fond of, which has to do with, you know, the battening down of sort of fake teams that fight other fake teams. And I'm not sure that beyond, you know, a brief sort of burst of jokes in the culture, that this kind of strategy as a way of breaking down, you know, patriarchy, racism, like things that these strategies are trying to address, I'm not sure they're the most effective way to do it.
Right. I guess the thing that I find slightly depressing about this trend, and, you know, I should say it is interesting. It is a real trend. I think Amanda's piece does a great job of both pointing to what it is and helping explain some of the reasons for its rise and some smart ways to think about it. But to me, the thing that's depressing about this trend is that it feels like it's more about feminism as a brand identity than feminism as a political or persuasive message. And it feels to me symptomatic of a time we live in where nobody is actually trying to talk to anybody else. They're only just talking to themselves, you know? And so it's kind of a funny thing to say amongst yourselves, right? I mean, you were saying yourself, Dan, that it's like, ooh, I'm on the team, guys. I get the joke. I'm on the team. I'm on the team, like, good modern people who believe that, you know, women have rights and are fully realized human beings. And, you know, I did not doubt you were on that team anyway, But I'm happy to further acknowledge your existence on that team because you liked my photo of myself in an I Drink Male Tears t-shirt, or that you would hypothetically like such a photo in the future. But I don't know. Didn't the women's rights movement arise out of the notion that one day we would all believe this? And it feels to me a little bit as though this trend suggests we're living in an era where it's like, well, some people are just going to be mean trolls on the internet and there's nothing we can do about that. So screw them and let's just hang out with all the cool kids who know what's what and like smugly exchange jokes.
I don't know. I sort of feel like one benefit of this is that it moves beyond sort of fruitless argument with those trolls and moves beyond even accepting their idiot worldview as being worth debating, and instead addresses it with the total contempt that it deserves. And one way that ironic misandry has sort of sprung up has been in a specific response to the men's rights movement, which, you know, is like the endless forever troll creating bugaboo of any conversation about women's rights or feminism on the web today, which is that, you know, that if you ever write any piece about feminism, some men's rights advocate is going to show up in the comments and just loudly yell at you about how men are actually subjugated by man haters like you. And so one of the things I like about ironic misandry is that it essentially refuses to yield any high ground to those people, and it instead uses the comic nature of this kind of response to brush a little dirt off your shoulder and be like, I'm perfectly happy to accede to the completely idiotic claim you are making in a comic way that makes clear that you are dumb. And I like that as a rhetorical device. I think it's a sometimes necessary rhetorical device in the age of the troll to be able to have a mechanism to completely dispense with someone as quickly and dismissively as possible.
But I guess I sometimes feel that trolls and troll-like people in the world are more visible than they are prevalent, and that it feels like a very feminist internet culture meme. And I think sometimes one of the problems with hanging out exclusively on the internet and talking to other internetties over your broadband on your Twitter and in your Tumblr and wherever else is that you just kind of forget the rest of the world and that there's change to be made there and people to talk to who are not, you know, like if you're aiming all of your rhetorical and intellectual and, you know, amusement rhyme generating firepower at like the asshole in the comments, like, isn't that sort of a waste of your resources?
But are people really doing that? I mean, I don't get the impression that comic misandry is the only arrow in the quiver of modern feminism, nor is it the only arrow in the quiver of most of the people who are using it.
That's
Mallory
true.
Ortberg writes plenty of things that are not just jokes about misandry, but in fact make substantive points about the world of women today. And so that is why I feel like this is useful. And I think that one thing that comic misandry allows women in some way is the right to occasionally actually experience real misandry and feel real misandry, which is a not illegitimate response to still the prevailing social structures in America today. I think it is a great way of dismissing trolls, but it's also a great way of stoking just a little tiny bit of feminist fire, and I don't mind that necessarily.
You know, I think I agree with you, Dan, that this use of the appropriation, right, the appropriation of someone else's criticism as part of your own strategy can be one arrow in the feminist quiver. But as far as its future as a rhetorical strategy, I don't know. I don't see a lot there. I think I'm with Julia, where I think dividing groups and pitting them against each other, even in fantasy and comically, is not necessarily the way to build a good future.
Yeah, I mean, I think humor is the saving grace of many rhetorical strategies, right? If you can get to it just being funny and eliciting a laugh, then it's a worthwhile rhetorical tool, I think, in some instances. And, you know, I'm not going to say I think that it's not a good idea at all, but I think it does point to just the fractured moment we're in on the web where we just talk to ourselves, and I find that a bit sad.
So I disagree to some respect. I don't actually think that this is a really that divisive of a tactic, and I don't think it actually points to any kind of fractured America. I think that one of the things I like about this comic tactic, and I was sort of joking about it at the beginning of our conversation, but sort of not, is that it is, in fact, I think, really inclusive. It allows all kinds of people to laugh together and get behind this absurd notion of what feminism might theoretically be. And so I feel like the real benefit of this is that as time goes on and as the arc of humanity bends toward moral justice, more and more people can understand the absurdity of these notions, laugh along with them, and enjoy them, while just simply cutting out these smaller and smaller and smaller percentages of dummies who still think that to believe in the rights of women is to hate men.
All right. Well, Dan, thank you for filling us in on the hatred of your sex and what a great idea it is.
Yeah. Finally, the man came and delivered the truth to us.
My pleasure, ladies.
Finally, the man came and set us straight.
Whew. Yep. Yep.
All right.
All right. So as regular listeners to the Gabfest may know, the Guardians of the Galaxy Awesome Mix number one, the portion of the soundtrack of Guardians of the Galaxy that is a mix of various 70s pop songs, is number one on the pop charts right now. I endorsed it a couple of weeks ago, and Julia the following week rebutted with some better soundtrack. So that got Dan Coyce thinking about us doing a segment about movie soundtracks, not movie scores of music composed specifically for movies, but movies that compile in an awesome mix sort of way, pop hits, usually of the decade that their movie is set in, but sometimes not. And we were going to bring in some of our own favorites and talk about the art of composing a movie soundtrack from bits of popular culture. So we brought in some favorites to talk about, and this is a huge conversation to have. But Dan, do you want to start since this was your pet topic?
Sure. And one of the things I want to talk about was not only just the way that songs are used in movies, which I think is always interesting and fun to talk about, but also about these soundtracks as products. You know, it's unique and surprising that Awesome Mix Volume 1 is number one on the Billboard charts. And in fact, it is the first ever non-score soundtrack album that is a soundtrack album made up completely of songs that had previously been released by other people to ever hit number one on the Billboard 200. Like, this has never happened before. But these albums have often served for many people as their entree into different worlds of music. So, for example, this is not the one that I'm going to talk about in depth today, but for example, the Big Chill soundtrack, for many people my age, was the first time we really heard a lot of sort of the great Motown hits of the 60s. The one that I want to focus on today is the soundtrack from a 2002 film called Morvern Keller. It was a movie I really liked when it first came out, and it is the last soundtrack album that I had ever purchased on CD. It's the last physical CD of a soundtrack album I ever bought. And it is a really amazing soundtrack for a couple of reasons. One, it's used really well in the movie. The movie has a very sort of spacey, ethereal, dreamy, mysterious feel to it, and the songs on the soundtrack really reflect that very well. But I also like it because, as is not always the case, but as is the case in Guardians of the Galaxy, the actual music plays a sort of plot-driving role in the movie. And so the soundtrack, for me, became not only a reminder of how much I love this movie, not only a reminder of the sort of amazing mental state that this movie put me in, it also became a really great introduction for me in 2002 to a lot of music I hadn't really heard before. I didn't really know Can, for example. But there's a great Can song called Spoon on this soundtrack. I also didn't know Lee Hazelwood. I didn't know Lee Scratch Perry and several of the other 70s artists that are on this. And so the whole soundtrack also became a great entree to me to entirely different kinds of music than I had ever heard before. And it has become one of the few albums in this age of shuffle that I will just listen to all the way through tracks 1 through 14, this soundtrack to Morvern Keller.
Wow, I might have to see that movie again. I remember finding that movie confusing, slow, and kind of boring. That's just the Philistine in me talking.
But you were like 12 when it came out.
I also have to say, Dan, that in reviewing my experience of movie soundtracks, I don't care that much about movie soundtracks. I think literally the only one I've ever owned and enjoyed was the Dazed and Confused one that I mentioned last week. It feels to me like there's two genres here. If we're talking about, you know, pre-existing song-based soundtrack albums, there's one where the director is just showing off his incredible taste in archive music. And I think the much more obvious thing to do with this kind of soundtrack, and it's what happened with Guardians of the Galaxy and these other soundtracks I endorsed last week, is to just like plant your flag in a decade and just plunk right down in Nostalgiaville. You often get an interesting sense of what the decade in which the film was made's view of the decade at which the nostalgia is aimed is through these soundtracks. Like, I think even in the distinction between the Dazed and Confused soundtrack and the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack, Dazed and Confused gives us a very, like, grungy, alt-y, 90s-feeling view of the 70s sound. And right now we live in the, like, electronic dance music, anthemic, like, every Rihanna track ever has. It makes you feel like you're in a booming hall full of wide-ranging, huge sounds. You know, the 70s songs selected for the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack have that feeling. They're huge, they're big, they're booming, they're sing-along-y, they're anthemic. So I think you can kind of glean a bit about the decade in which the film was made from the way it mines the subject decade for particular nostalgia nuggets.
I actually brought in a few examples of soundtracks that do exactly that when I was trying to think of great soundtracks in the past. And unlike you, Julia, I'm a huge fan of movie soundtracks. I mean, scores especially, music that's composed especially for a film. But I have a lot of cherished albums that are movie soundtracks as well. And one of them I was going to mention that's a great sort of early 80s view back on the 50s is the soundtrack to Diner, the Barry Levinson movie set in Baltimore. That's sort of about a group of aimless young men. Stars Mickey Rourke and, I don't know, every young male star of the 80s. And the vision that it has of 50s music was something that was new to me. I mean, the 50s were so, with Happy Days and, you know, American Graffiti, I feel like there was a certain vision of the 50s that we had in the 70s and 80s. And Diner kind of changed that up a little bit. It brought like a little bit more blackness into the music than you heard on Happy Days. And some other movies that have that sort of decade-specific nostalgia as seen from a later decade include Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights, of course, great, another great 70s soundtrack, constructs a very specific 70s. Songs that you might not have thought about, you know, really some of them sort of just really tinny AM radio songs,
right,
that died a quick death, you know, but that were revived wonderfully by PTA and Boogie Nights.
One thing I want to point out here is that these mixtapes are not all really actually always made for you by the director. There are music supervisors whose entire job is to create these things, to find the right songs for moods, and to generate not only the music for the movie, but then also the music that ends up on a soundtrack album, which once used to be a valuable marketing technique and a revenue source for these films that might otherwise struggle to make money. And so, you know, for Wes Anderson, it's Randall Poster, who has been his music supervisor for years and years and for many movies. And obviously, it's Wes Anderson's taste that drives a lot of these selections, but it's also Randall Poster going out and getting a lot of these songs and making these things happen. One of my fondest wishes always for the Academy from year to year is for there to be an award for music supervision, basically. I mean, they give awards for score, they give an award for an original song, but there is no award to recognize what is so valuable for movies as highbrow as Wes Anderson movies and as lowbrow or middlebrow as Guardians of the Galaxy, which is the songs you select for your movie can make or break that movie. And it's an unbelievably important part of filmmaking. And it's a shame that there's like no award for it.
All right. Well, we'll throw this one out to listeners as well, because I'm curious, what for you is the perfect marriage of song, original music, and screen image? Let us know at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Well, folks, we've made it through another show, and it's time for endorsements. Julia, what have you got?
My endorsement this week is a favorite movie moment of mine. There is a moment in Postcards from the Edge, which I think maybe isn't even a movie I've ever seen all the way through, but there's a scene towards the conclusion where Meryl Streep is playing an actress, and in the role she's playing within the movie, she has to like nail a country song. She has to sing a country song and nail the performance for the movie. And it also is representative of whatever's going on with her character. And then also within that, you see Meryl Streep being like, man, that woman can do anything, but can she like really sing a country song? So there's all these layers of can she do it-ness to the scene. And the song she sings is called "I'm Checking Out of This Heartbreak Hotel." And it's this country song that was actually written by Shel Silverstein, who wrote a ton of country songs, but it's not one that, you know, is famous as A Boy Named Sue or anything like that. And Meryl Streep sings it, and it's a little bit warbly, and it's a little bit off pitch, but it just has great lyrics and a great rhythm. And somehow it became this totemic thing in my family growing up where we would all sing it all together. I think around the time that my mom was quitting a job, and we would all just imitate all of Meryl's vocal warbles down to the tiniest little quiver, and all of her, you know, she gets like growly at certain points and goes high at certain points. And it's just one of my favorite performances by an actor singing a song. So check it out on YouTube. It's Meryl Streep singing "I'm Checking Out of This Heartbreak Hotel" from Postcards from the Edge.
Sounds great. Dan, what have you got?
I'm going to recommend the third novel in Lieve Grossman's Magicians trilogy. It's called The Magician's Land, and it just came out last week. And The Magicians, as some listeners may know, is a big best-selling novel, now a trilogy, by the book critic for Time magazine. And it is best described as Harry Potter, but with sex and drugs. It is about a school for magic that kids get into, but it is more like an actual high school than Hogwarts is, in that everyone has sex with each other and drinks a lot and does a lot of drugs and uses magic for extremely bad ideas. But it was a great capper to a trilogy, in a way that trilogy cappers are not always that great. Often the third book is where these things go all to hell.
All right, so we have a song and a book so far, and I'm going to go with a movie. And this is related to our soundtrack discussion from earlier. I didn't get into this in our discussion because this is one of those tragic cases where the soundtrack album has almost none of the great songs from the movie. But I'm sort of going to endorse the whole movie because I think everyone should just see it. It's 1983's Valley Girl, directed by Martha Coolidge.
Yes!
It was Nick Cage's first big role. He had done a tiny role in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, but it's his first real debut, and he's fantastic in it, absolutely fabulous. When you first see his eyes peek up over the shower stall at the moment that he first sort of meets up with his Juliet, it's sort of a Romeo and Juliet story, Valley Girl, set in the San Fernando Valley. It's to me is one of the great kind of romantic lead debuts of all time. And even though the main actress in this movie is sort of completely uninteresting, Nick Cage kind of brings out the best in her and really sort of seems like he's falling for this fairly generic actress named Deborah Foreman. But there's all kinds of great side roles. Frederick Forrest is the dad, is really, really funny. And Valley Girl is just tons of 80s fun. So Valley Girl from 1983, that's my endorsement. All right. Thanks a lot, Julia, as always.
Thanks, Dana.
And thank you, Dan, for sitting in. It was great.
Thanks, guys.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And one program note, this is the last episode of Gabfest Radio. We've loved joining you each weekend for the last 2 years, and we've loved all the feedback you've sent. But though you won't hear us on the air anymore, the Culture and Political Gabfest will still be available as podcasts. Just search for Slate Gabfest in iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Max Tanney and Josephine Livingston. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Dana Stevens. Thanks for listening. Good master.